and welcome to the Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Murtazavi, a journalist and political analyst, and also a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington. In this episode, you're going to hear a discussion about Iran 1 year after the death of Mahsa Amini. We recently had this panel discussion at the Stimson Center here in Washington, D.C., and I was joined by Nader Hashemi, a professor at Georgetown University, Kelsey Davenport, director for non-proliferation policy at the Arms Control Association, and Farnaz Fasihi, United Nations Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And the panel was hosted and moderated by Barbara Slavin, a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. The panel discussion was held on September 11th of 2023. Here's that discussion.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Barbara Slavin. I'm a distinguished fellow here at the Stimson Center. And here we have a program called Middle East Voices, focusing on the Middle East. Today, however, we are going to be putting the spotlight on Iran, a situation in the country, and the state of Iran's relations with its neighbors and with the United States as we approach the anniversary on September 16th of the death of Mahsa Amini in the custody of the so-called morality police. This young Kurdish woman was arrested, allegedly for not wearing her headscarf properly, and she was beaten so badly that she died. The Iranian government has never admitted responsibility. It has never punished anyone, as far as we know, for her death. We know about her death because of photos that were taken of Mahsa when she was in the hospital, hooked up to breathing apparatus, and also photos of her parents grieving in the hallway of the hospital after she died. As we all know, this touched off spontaneous protests in Iran that lasted many months, also protests around the world. In Iran, some 500 protesters were killed by security forces. Thousands were arrested. Seven people were executed. The protests have ebbed under this repression, but as we know, there are still many, many grievances in Iran about Mahsa and other issues. At the same time this has been going on, Iran has doubled down on its alliance with Russia and China. It's sought to diffuse tensions with its Arab neighbors and to some extent even with the United States. It has slowed the accumulation of highly enriched uranium, but it is still not cooperating fully with international inspectors. So we thought this would be an appropriate time to talk about all things Iran, and I'm very pleased that we have assembled a truly expert panel. We will make time for your questions. We invite you to input them at stimson.org/questions, and we look forward to an enlightening and civil discussion. So we're going to begin virtually. Hi, Farnaz. I see.
Hi, everybody. Good to see you.
With Farnaz Fasihi, who is Communications Bureau Chief for the New York Times, but who is also a longtime expert on Iran, which she covered both for the Times and as a senior writer and correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Then we're going to turn here at Stimson to Negar Murtazavi, also a veteran expert on Iran, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, where she hosts the Iran podcast, which is a great repository of information on Iran. After Negar, we'll go back virtually to Kelsey Davenport, Director for Nonproliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association, who knows more than most of us about Iran's nuclear program, and we'll get an update on that. And then finally back here at Stimson to Nader Hashemi, the new director of the Alawite Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University, and the author of many books on the Middle East, including Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy Toward a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies. So we are in good hands, I think, and let's get started. We're going to begin with Farnaz. We know that the Iranian government has been arresting members of the families of those who protested and those killed in the protests last year. They've been taking other steps to try to preempt a new outbreak of protests on September 16th, slowing the internet, that sort of thing. At the same time, I hear from friends in Iran that women, at least in Tehran, are not wearing the hijab, which was, of course, the spark for this whole protest. So give us your latest understanding of the situation on the ground in Iran.
Hi, Barbara, and everybody else. Good to see you. Thank you for having me. As you mentioned, we're approaching the anniversary of Mahsa Jinnah Amini's death, or death by in the custody of morality police, killing her while she was in custody on Saturday. And from about a month or so ago, we've seen the government intensifying its crackdown in preparation for the anniversary. To signal that, you know, openly they've said, the spokesman for the judiciary has even said that if protesters come out, if the people that we arrested return to the streets, we will show no mercy. In the past couple of weeks, university professors have been dismissed from their jobs. They've been fired. The professors who were outspoken supporters of the uprising, women's rights activists have been rounded up and arrested. Journalists are getting detained and also getting heavy-handed sentences. As you mentioned, the family members of many of the killed protesters are either getting detained, they're getting harassed, they're being warned not to participate in any anniversary ceremonies. And even the parents of Mahsa Amini are under a lot of pressure to not speak to the media or not issue a call for people to come. They've said in a statement that they plan to honor her on the anniversary and have a ceremony at the graveside, but they've said that our situation is such that we can't really call for protests. So when you put all of this together, a picture emerges of the government knowing that the Islamic Republic regime and the government knowing that the discontent that sort of erupted on the streets is not over. They've managed to crush the manifestation of that on the streets, but I think the aspirations for wholesale change, the desire to topple the Islamic Republic and find a new path is very much alive. And they want to make the cost so heavy that people won't necessarily, come to the streets. They won't show this outwardly. But as you mentioned, the most visible and enduring public sign of this resistance is women defying the mandatory hijab law, right? So not just in Tehran, but in many other cities, even in smaller towns, we're hearing that women continue to stage this collective civil disobedience by not wearing the headscarf. They're wearing not just that, but they're also not wearing the long coats that they were mandated to wear to cover their bodies. They're coming out dressed as they wish. And despite, the government trying very hard to crack down on them by fining them, sending them text messages that they will confiscate their cars, or, this law that's currently being considered by the parliament with some, draconian regulations, including like not banning women from leaving the country, the women are not giving up. So this shows that things are not just not the same. The relationship between the people and the Islamic Republic is not the same and will not go back. The discontent is spreading to population that were typically supportive and sympathetic to the Islamic Republic. We saw during the Shia ceremony of Ashura that many of the people who were gathering to mourn were using this opportunity to protest, and they were singing protest songs instead of the Shia religious songs. So the dissent and this feeling of being fed up with the status quo is very much alive. And, Iran's unpredictable. Another incident could trigger it and it could erupt. So that's basically the situation right now.
Coming to you, Negar, here, what would you add to that picture? What do you anticipate will happen in Iran on the anniversary. Are there other things that the government is doing to try to distract world attention from the anniversary of Mahsa Amini's death? And here I'm thinking in particular about the release of five Americans who have been held in Iran for varying amounts of time. And there have been rumors that perhaps this is the week that they will finally be allowed to leave.
Sure. Thanks, Barbara, for inviting us. Thanks to the Stimson Center for hosting this timely conversation. So I'll add to this, and then maybe later on I can talk more about the prisoner swap. I think not much to add. Farnaz does a great job of reporting as if she's on the ground, actually, in Iran. But I think the government is trying its best. We've seen pressure on universities, on various labor movements, activists, families of those killed in prison, journalists, to try to prevent another mass wave of protests. Iranian diaspora also are organizing protests across the world. And as you said, the anniversary of Mahsa Amini's killing, death in custody, is coming up this weekend on the 16th of September, which it's anticipated to be mass protests again across the world and inside Iran. As far as the prisoner swap, we are hearing, you know, trickling of reports and rumors that I'll talk about the logistics of that later if you want. But basically, Iran and the U.S. are on the verge of this prisoner swap. Five dual national Iranian-Americans on the Iranian side, the longest held, Siamak Namazi, since 2016, Emad Shaari, Murad Tahbaz, and two others whose families did not wish to share the names. And then I just got the names of the Iranians detained here in the U.S. who will be essentially swapped with the five: Mehrdad Moin Ansari, Kamviz Attar Kashani, Reza Sarangpur, Amin Hassanzadeh, and Kaveh Afrasiabi, mostly related to sanctions, evasions detained here in the U.S. And it's part of a complex, essentially, deal or agreement that's been in the making through indirect negotiations with mediation from Qatar, other trusted partners, Oman, Switzerland, and it seems to be imminent, about to happen maybe this week. And what we're hearing is one rumor that you mentioned is that the actual swap might happen right on the anniversary of the protests. Again, rumors, reporting, but anyways, it may be coinciding. And essentially what's happening is Iran's frozen funds in South Korea that had been sitting in South Korea for years have been unfrozen, going through Europe, will end up in banks in Qatar with oversight from the Qatari government to be spent on humanitarian transactions, food, medicine, some medical supplies, anything that's non-sanctionable. As far as transactions by the U.S., and then in exchange, the part of the swap, which is 5 for 5. And once that money arrives in Qatar, which could be anytime this week, that elaborate or choreographed steps of the swap, releasing the prisoners, the detainees, the dual nationals in Iran have been moved to a hotel in different rooms, same level. I hear they have phones now, access to internet, but still detained, essentially like a house arrest situation. They will eventually be released through Qatar to Doha. And then the Iranians, it's not clear how many of the Iranian prisoners would actually want to return to Iran. Some live here. There's one who is actually a Canadian resident. But this would be the swap that is imminently happening. We also know that the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, is set to come to New York for the UN General Assembly. And so different steps going to be sort of following each other in the month of September.
Yeah, very much so. It's going to be a news-packed few days, I think, for Iran. As we are speaking today, there's something else going on involving Iran, which is a meeting in Vienna of the IAEA Board of Governors, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And they have been considering a new report on Iran's nuclear program. So, Kelsey Davenport, we will go to you next. We also have a press conference, I believe, that Raphael Grossi gave earlier this morning, in which he expressed some concern. He said that there was a certain routinization when it comes to Iran's nuclear program, as though with everything else going on in the world, the war in Ukraine, conflicts potentially with China and so on, it's as though the Western countries are tired of talking about Iran's nuclear program, even though, as we know, Iran has quite a substantial stockpile of highly enriched uranium. So what is the status of the program? What does the latest IAEA report have to say? Are there any bright spots, or is it all pretty gloomy?
Well, thank you so much for having me, Barbara, and thanks to Stimson for hosting this event. It's great to join you all. I'm sorry I can't be there in person. So before talking about the specifics of this report on Iran's nuclear program and the developments going on in Vienna right now, I think, you know, we do have to look back over the past, you know, 4.5 years since Iran announced in 2019 that it would begin violating the JCPOA's commitments. And since then, we've seen a very steady progression of Iran expanding its nuclear program and beginning to engage in new nuclear activities that both allow Iran to move much more quickly to nuclear weapons if the political decision were ever made to do so, and are much more difficult to reverse. And by difficult to reverse, I mean Iran has expanded its capabilities. It's enriching uranium to 60%, a level near weapons grade. It had not done that prior to the JCPOA. And it's using more advanced centrifuge machines that enrich uranium more quickly. And as a result of these activities, you know, Iran has gained significant, you know, new nuclear knowledge that really cannot be undone. So that's why when we talk about Iran's reduction in the production of 60% enriched uranium, which is, I think, the main kind of headline from this most recent International Atomic Energy Agency report, you know, we have to put it in that context, that finally, after 4.5 years of expansion and acceleration, Iran has taken sort of a very limited step to decelerate. Now, from an actual risk perspective, you know, Iran's decision to slowly reduce its production of uranium enriched to 60%, you know, isn't really that meaningful. I mean, Iran still has enough material enriched to this level that, if enriched to a weapons grade, which is 90%, would be enough for 3 bombs. You know, if it decided to pursue enough material for weapons, it could produce, you know, 5 nuclear weapons worth of weapons grade uranium, you know, within a month. So the risk is still significant, you know, when compared to the timeline for that first weapon, you know, being a year, that first quantity of weapons grade uranium being a year, you know, when the JCPOA was fully implemented. So the risk is still there. And the non-proliferation value of the 60% step is really non-existent. But that doesn't mean it's insignificant. I mean, Iran puts considerable political importance on its stockpile of highly enriched uranium. This is a key source of leverage in its negotiations with the United States. So I think we have to view any move on the 60% as, you know, an indication of Iran's willingness to de-escalate and an opportunity to pursue, you know, further steps. And as we look forward to thinking about how to further de-escalate the nuclear risk posed by Iran's program, I think the Biden administration in Europe has to be focused on enhancing monitoring and verification. I mean, you mentioned this morning the press conference from the International Atomic Energy Agency's Director General Raphael Grossi. And in addition to talking about the routinization of addressing Iran's nuclear program, you know, he also expressed that he doesn't feel the agency is getting the support that it needs from the states, you know, in pressing its case forward. And so I think progress on enhancing IAEA monitoring would go a long way, both in terms of upholding the nonproliferation regime, you know, and supporting the IAEA safeguards mandate, but also de-escalating tensions with Iran and setting the stage for future negotiations. I mean, as positive as the 60% news was in the IAEA reports, the agency also referenced that there's been no progress in expanding its monitoring of Iran's nuclear capabilities. And that's deeply problematic because there are certain facilities that the agency has not had access to since February of 2021. And the problem here really is twofold. I mean, first, it drives speculation that Iran might be diverting materials like centrifuges to a covert program. There's no real risk right now that Iran is diverting the actual nuclear material itself because the IAEA still has access to those facilities. But there is real concern about the IAEA's ability to monitor other areas, you know, like the centrifuge development. And so not only does that pose a risk as we try to assess the proliferation threat from Iran, but it also poses a risk to a future deal. Under the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, the president has to issue a certification about the IAEA's ability to verify any deal reached with Iran. Now, if the IAEA does not have an accurate picture of how many centrifuges Iran has produced, how much uranium ore concentrate Iran has produced, it's going to be hard for the administration to say that the IAEA can really verify, you know, restrictions or limitations laid out in a future deal. So focusing on the monitoring going forward, I think, provides more assurance that Iran's program is peaceful, that there is not material being diverted for a covert program. And like I said, it really creates that space, helps rebuild the IAEA's knowledge of Iran's program to maintain, you know, time and space for a future deal to be negotiated. So that's why I think, you know, this really is a mixed bag. Iran may be sending a political signal about the 60%, but the failure to work more cooperatively with the IAEA really does have long-term ramifications. And I said in the short term, it's going to drive speculation that Iran's program is not peaceful and that it has nefarious intentions, even if there's no intelligence to back that up.
I'll ask you one follow-up, and that is, you mentioned a follow-up deal. I mean, most of us, many of us have concluded that what remains of Biden's first term, there will be no deal per se. There's no indication that there are any formal negotiations going on as far as we know. And Congress certainly would be hostile most likely to any kind of new agreement with Iran. So what is your expectation, frankly, for the next year or so? Do you think we're going to continue to see these steps, coordinated or not, between the U.S. and Iran on the nuclear front, but no formal agreement in black and white?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I was a big supporter of the 2015 nuclear deal. It was an effective, verifiable agreement. As much as it pains me to say, you know, there's no going back to the JCPOA at this point. Iran's program is too advanced and we're too far into the U.S. election cycle, I think, for that to be a real viable alternative. So I think what the Biden administration and the E3 have to focus on right now is further de-escalatory steps to stabilize the current crisis. Iran's move on 60% is necessary, but it's not sufficient. It's like slowing down, you know, the treadmill when we really need Iran to be moving backwards. So that's why I think trying to incentivize Iran to take further steps first on the monitoring and verification to enhance IAEA monitoring and access, you know, that should be the first priority. And then to try to encourage some limited steps that reduce, you know, proliferation risk. That could be taking the stockpiles of highly enriched uranium and converting them to a less proliferation sensitive form, like a powder, that would allow Iran to retain its leverage but reduce immediate proliferation risk. And ideally, I think this would buy, like I said, the time and space to get through the next election cycle and reconsider what a nuclear agreement with Iran should look like that actually has a better chance of being sustainable and actually can deliver some of the benefits that, you know, Iran is looking for under a deal, which, you know, we saw the JCPOA, you know, being unable to do even when it was fully implemented by all parties. So that's what I really think the focus has to be on going forward, de-escalation and stabilization to create that space for a new deal with the new administration.
Thank you. Nader, you've been very patient. As all of this is going on, we are also seeing shifts within the region and beyond. Iran has been aggressively joining various groupings of mostly developing economies, Central Asian groups like the SCO, the BRICS now, It has restored a diplomatic relationship with Saudi Arabia after many years of being very much on the outs. What do you make of the current foreign policy of the Iranian government, and how do you think it is helping or not Iran's internal situation, which I know you also monitor very closely?
The short answer is it's symbolically very important, but I don't think it really makes much of a difference internally. So obviously the deal that was struck with its long-standing regional rival, Saudi Arabia, is important, and it's obviously a positive development in the sense that it diminishes regional tensions, particularly in Yemen, where, you know, there was, you know, horrific war crimes taking place. It also contributes to this general trend that we're seeing in Iran, and it has been hinted at already, at de-escalation, that Iran has an interest in de-escalating, has an interest in this hostage swap, it has an interest in trying to perhaps create some safe space for possibility of negotiations down the road. All of this raises questions. Why is Iran interested in these types of moves, de-escalating the hostage swap, you know, joining other organizations? And I think the only explanation as to the why now question is that the internal, you know, economic conditions, political conditions in Iran are quite drastic. You know, maintaining the status quo is not an option given, you know, what Farhan has just described in terms of the general discontent and the crisis of legitimacy that the regime is facing. So the BRICS, you know, announcement last week was a big deal, but, you know, there's a very distinguished, you know, commentator and analyst of Iran whose, you know, opinions I value, Trita Parsi, who tweeted on that particular point that what's really important about the BRICS negotiation is it suggests that our world is moving into a multipolar world where the United States can no longer be, you know, the gatekeeper in terms of who can participate in the international community and who can't. But if you actually look at the, you know, composition of the BRICS countries, Ethiopia was invited, Egypt was invited, Argentina was invited. Those aren't economic powerhouses that are going to come to the rescue of the Iranian economy. But I think symbolically, it sort of sends a message to the United States that, you know, we're living in a different world. And I think a lot of these moves also reveal the role of China in trying to sort of, you know, assert its muscle and push back against moves by the United States to quarantine and isolate China on the global stage. So I think those are the things that are happening that are important.
Yeah. You're reminding me of a trip I took to Iran in 2012. For a non-aligned summit. I mean, who remembers the non-aligned movement? But this was, I guess, President Ahmadinejad at the time was very excited to be hosting the summit of the non-aligned movement in Tehran. And they pulled out all the stops for all of these various folks from Africa and Latin America and so on. So I kind of see the BRICS in the same way. We've also had the president of Iran visit Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela this past summer. And he also went to Africa, to Uganda, Zimbabwe, and Kenya. So one begins to see a certain theme here. But it's not, as you point out, really having a tangible effect on the Iranian economy. There were some statistics that I saw recently. Iranians today find themselves with the same buying power they had 15 years ago, and that's in the cities. In the rural areas, it's even worse off, with purchasing power equivalent to levels from 1998. And that's from an Iran-based organization called Tehran Bazaar. So I think it's to think that joining all these various groups is going to make a difference. For Iranians on the ground, not so much. Farnaz, let me come back to you. We'll do another round, and then I'm going to start to take some questions from all of you. You've written a lot about the Iranian economy, the situation with the economy. Inflation is terrible. People are not eating meat very often. How are Iranians coping with this very, very drastic economic crisis?
As you mentioned, Barbara, the everyday basket of Iranians is shrinking. Their purchasing power is shrinking because the currency keeps devaluing against the dollar with all this tension that Iran has, you know, whether it's domestic policy or foreign policy. Iran's economic policies are not separate from, cannot be separated from its foreign policy, from its regional policy. And, you know, there's a massive amount of corruption in Iran. There's also mismanagement of resources, mismanagement of funds in every sector. And then you have the added layer of international sanctions targeting particularly its banking and its oil sales. So when you put all of the package, all of that together, for the average Iranian, what they really see is that they have to keep eliminating food items from their grocery baskets. I've interviewed families, middle-class families, that say, well, we first cut red meat, then we cut out chicken, and now we can't even afford dairy. So we're just, you know, surviving on beans and lentil and rice and whatnot. And this isn't just, you know, this is the working class, the middle class. And at the same time, you know, the very rich or the people that are the businessmen, the Revolutionary Guards associates that are involved in the economy are getting richer and richer and richer. And if you go to North Tehran, you think that there's, you know, this is an affluent country. The cafes are full, the restaurants are full, but that's not representative of the entire population, with the majority struggling economically. So I think economic discontent is a big part of Iranian grievances, because when you talk to young people, when I talk to young people, you know, college graduates, they say that we don't really see a way forward for ourselves in terms of being able to find jobs that will allow us to leave our parents' home, to be independent, to even buy a car. Many of the graduates are thinking of immigrating. Immigration has once again spiked in the past couple of years. And those who stay, many of them, like I spoke to, interviewed a 25-year-old architect who said that he's working at as a clerk in a clothes shop, and most of his friends are either taxi drivers, the equivalent of Uber, or working in shops. Not a single person from his graduating class actually had a job in architecture, engineering. So this is really tragic. Young people feel the social oppression, of course, but they also feel an economic dead end. And this is all contributing to this deep feeling of discontent and the sense that they're really, their lives are being held hostage to these policies of Iran that don't really make any sense in terms of prosperity or quality of life for Iranians.
I think I read somewhere that something like 6,000 Iranian doctors have left just in the last year. So what that means also in terms of quality of life is really shocking.
The doctors are being doctors and nurses are being recruited, particularly by Arab countries in the Persian Gulf and Oman, Qatar, UAE, with very lucrative packages. And you know, post COVID. In Iran, with the disastrous COVID management and then the political domestic issues that happened and the economy, really anyone who has a chance to leave Iran seems to be looking for a way to get out. And it is tragic.
Thank you. Nigar, the Biden administration approach to Iran, particularly lately, seems to be one of basically wishing the country would go away. Very little mention of developments regarding Iran, a reluctance to speak about these issues, even something like hostage releases, unless kind of forced to. What do you make of the Biden policy toward Iran now? And what are some of the other steps that the administration could take? We have a piece up on our website today that talks about things like increasing the number of visas for Iranians who want to come here, making that easier, doing more in terms of providing circumvention tools for the internet. I don't know if Elon Musk is in the mood to provide Starlink to yet another beleaguered country, but these kinds of steps, One of the things that I've been advocating is an ability to pay Iranians for work that is legitimate and non-sanctioned, or for Iranians in the diaspora to be able to send money home in a way that does not involve, $100 bills in a suitcase. So what is your impression of the policy? What more do you think the administration could do?
Well, let's take a step back and look at how we got here, a little bit of the trajectory, essentially starting with the previous administration pulling out of the nuclear deal, a deal that was working and containing, heavily monitoring Iran's nuclear program, as Kelsey mentioned, increasing tensions, assassination of Iranian top generals. And what I think that brought, the maximum pressure campaign, essentially bringing the two countries to the brink of war, it just made things worse in every possible way. When we look at the nuclear program, it expanded, and Iran engaged in essentially an escalation of its nuclear program, increasing enrichment, reducing the monitoring in various different ways that Kelsey mentioned. When it comes to Iran's regional presence, even the assassination of the top general responsible for Iran's regional policy, I don't think the regional policy has changed. In fact, I would argue it's gotten more hostile towards the U.S. with, right after the assassination, Iranians directly shooting at U.S. forces from Iranian soil. When it comes to the domestic situation, human rights, it hasn't gotten any better. I argue it's gotten even worse for the Iranian civil society, various rights movements, the relative moderates of the Iranian political spectrum have been weakened. The pro-diplomacy camp, I would call them, they've been weakened, isolated. The hardliners in Iran have consolidated power first in the Iranian parliament, then with the presidency, hardline and ultra-conservative. And we've seen an increased crackdown and repression of the protests of the various rights movements in the country. And then also with tensions with the West, we're talking about a prisoner swap. My assessment is that it's gotten worse when it comes to detaining American, European, dual national, non-dual national, various citizens. Most recently, a European official, even, who still detained, a Swedish citizen who was detained in Iran. So the overall trajectory, starting with the previous administration, going into this administration, has just been an increasing of tensions and the potential for conflict. Now, I think both sides, Iran and the U.S., are trying to avoid a full-on war, are not interested in a military conflict. Nevertheless, you can sleepwalk into a conflict that you're not interested in. And I think with the raising of tensions, lack of diplomatic channels, the boiling of this underneath will just increase. As far as the Biden administration, I think this is a positive step, what's happening with the prisoner swap. It's not perfect. It took a very long time, almost a year. I hear at least 8 rounds of indirect negotiations through Qatar, shuttle diplomacy with diplomats in 2 different hotels, to just get to this swapping of 5 with 5. But it seems like both sides decided this is a doable step. It's a smaller step. It can be a gateway, an opening, something to be an intro to more negotiations and agreements. And it seems like it's going to happen and be successful. But I think what the administration missed, I have been talking about it, I'll say it again, at the beginning of President Biden, of the presidency, there was a window of opportunity. I think it was a golden window of opportunity for 6 months when they coincided again with the relative moderates, the more pro-diplomacy camp in Tehran. And that was the opportunity to return to the JCPOA as candidate Biden had promised, and restart sort of serious negotiations. Unfortunately, that window was missed. It hit the Iranian presidential election, and now a conservative hardline administration who has very different outlook and methods and goals when it comes to their engagement or lack of with the United States. And so we are where we are. It's a very different world now. Iran has made more of that shift. They had started to the east towards Russia, China. They're involved in the war in Ukraine, much more closer to Russia. And when it comes to the region also, I see that as, and Nadar, I'd like to hear more from you, but more of that shift away from the West, that we're going to resolve our own issues with this shift to the east. Even the agreement with Saudi Arabia was in a way brokered by China. So as far as what the administration can do, I think to reduce tensions, as Kelsey was mentioning, maybe move this into more agreements when it comes to more serious issues, the nuclear program obviously being the top for the U.S., its allies. I also agree with you. I don't think there's enough time for a deal or a return to the JCPOA per se, but more of an understanding and de-escalation, which means compromise. When you get something, you give something, which seems to be the difficult thing to understand in Washington, that when it comes to dealing with Iran, you have to do something. And as far as steps for the Iranian people, as you mentioned, the administration throughout the past year, the protests have done, I think, relatively small steps, but some symbolic, for example, removing Iran from the Committee on the Status of Women in the United Nations, that was symbolic. The United States led that. And as far as sanctions, interestingly, a removal of, not removal of sanction, but allowing Iranians more use of technology and internet. Surprisingly, the United States also plays a role in limiting Iranians' access to internet, who are already limited by their own government. So essentially getting out of the way or trying to help with circumvention tools so that they can access and have more free flow of information. But just to wrap it up, as far as domestic, I don't think there is much the United States can do to make revolutionary change. That's something we have to come to terms with in Washington. But just showing solidarity and trying to do the small steps here and there is a sort of
I actually helpful. Disagree somewhat with Negar on that point.
Go ahead. What more would you like to see the United States?
Well, I think there's more than the Biden administration can do, but they have to be thinking long-term rather than short-term. There's an attitude in this city and in some Western capitals that if we just squeeze Iran, the regime's going to collapse and we can all, you know, celebrate the return of the baby Shah of Iran and the Middle East will be a wonderful place. I mean, that's the attitude, unfortunately, many people. But it's deeply ignorant and naive. Since we're at the first anniversary of, you know, the mass protests that followed Mahsa Amini's death, I think there's lessons to be learned about mass mobilization, the struggle for democracy in Iran, and U.S. foreign policy, specifically with respect to sanctions. Now, let me be very clear. I'm in favor of sanctions against Iran, targeted sanctions against people who have blood on their hands. But I think the sanctions that we've seen imposed on Iran, particularly after Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal, have been so punitive and catastrophic in terms of hurting the average Iranian citizen, particularly the middle class, that it's inhibited mass mobilization that we saw in Iran in an earlier period in 2009. So there is this deep and intimate relationship between the economic precariousness of the average Iranian citizen and mass mobilization. Those two things don't go together. If you follow the data that we have over the protests that took place over the last year, it was largely young people who came out to demonstrate, 15 to 25. Above 25 in Iran, very few people came out. And the reason is not difficult to fathom. If you have a family, if you sort of are dependent on your job, if you don't go to work, if you lose your job, your family doesn't eat the next day. The statistics that we have in Iran, the glaring one that sort of really shocked me when I saw it, and these are official government statistics, is one third of Iranians now are living in absolute poverty. That's a function both of economic mismanagement, but largely external sanctions. So if we are serious, and that's a big if we are serious in this country about supporting the struggle for democracy in Iran, I think there has to be a complete recalculation and rethinking of the type of sanctions that we want to see on Iran. The current sanctions, I would argue, are undermining the struggle for democracy in Iran, inadvertently strengthening Iranian hardliners, and undermining, I think, the prospects for a better Iran down the road through some sort of, you know, mass mobilization. So that's what I think needs to happen. Whether it's going to happen, whether the Biden administration is able of doing that type of rethinking, I'm not holding my breath, but I think that's where the conversation and a serious policy review needs to happen.
I'm old enough to remember. Sure, I'm old enough to remember when Biden came in and appointed somebody at the Treasury Department specifically to reevaluate sanctions. But all of that seems to have gone by the board since Ukraine. Yes, go ahead.
Nader, I don't disagree with you. I agree with everything you said. So I just.
No. But when you said that, I don't think there's much the Biden administration can do to help the internal situation in Iran. That's what I was commenting on.
What they cannot do, which is not squeeze the average Iranians when it comes to these broad economic sanctions.
I agree with you on that.
Yes.
Yeah. It does seem, though, that the sanctions are not being enforced quite as stringently, at least when it comes to oil sales. And I don't know if this is because the Biden administration lacks the capacity or lacks the will to clamp down. And Farnas, maybe you want to come in on this. I mean, we are seeing reports that Iran is producing over 2 million barrels of oil a day, up to maybe 3 million barrels of oil a day, exporting over 1 million barrels of oil a day, primarily to China. And efforts, there are sort of sporadic or periodic efforts to clamp down. But given the fact that Saudi Arabia has been cutting production to keep the price of oil high, and the Biden administration has to worry about an election coming up, do you see that the administration is, in effect, slowing the enforcement of sanctions?
Barbara, we reported this in the New York Times. I think we broke the story, I think, about a month and a half ago or so about the Iran and Biden administration reaching and working, negotiating quietly for an informal agreement. And this was done through the meetings, indirect meetings between Brett McGurk and Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, Baveri, who went to Oman. And part of the conversation between the Iranians and the Americans was de-escalation. And in fact, a prominent Iranian foreign policy commentator told me that we call it a political ceasefire with the U.S. And as part of that so-called political ceasefire, the agreement was that Iran would not enrich beyond 60%. It would de-escalate tensions in the region in terms of targeting, having its proxy militia in Syria and in Iraq target American bases. And in return, the U.S. would kind of ease the enforcement of oil sanctions. And the prisoner deal was part of this broader deal. It kind of fell into this broader quiet agreement between the U.S. and Iran to de-escalate things. And I think that's, as you pointed out, this is election season in the U.S., and I think it would be very difficult for President Biden, as he campaigned, if Iran were to, it is already a nuclear threshold. It's past the nuclear threshold line, but in order if it would suddenly go up to 90%, it would risk a conflict with Israel. I also cover extensively the shadow war between Iran and Israel. If that were to happen, Israel could strike Iran. The U.S. might be kind of cornered into some sort of military reaction. And I think that's something that they wanted to avoid. So I think in the absence of a JCPOA 2 or return to JCPOA, the U.S. administration had to thought that, okay, we have a problem with Iran. The regime doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Doesn't seem to be toppling. The nuclear program is advancing. These regional tensions are escalating. And so they started engaging Iran diplomatically. I think that we're already seeing the effects on that. The attacks on U.S. military bases are down both in Syria and in Iraq. And as you've seen, reports that Iran is now selling 2 million barrels a day of oil at a discounted price to mainly China. And this is pre-sanction level of oil sales per day.
I'm going to start to incorporate questions. So if there are folks here who have them, please raise a hand. We have a small audience here at Stinson. Yeah, go ahead, Trita. Wait for a microphone, if you would.
To last year, it appears to me that some of the structural challenges that the movement had, lack of leadership, inability to connect with other strata of society, appears not to have been fixed. But would like to give your comments on that, particularly in light of the issue of sanctions, because the lack of leadership also led to a leadership vacuum in which voices on the outside tried to fill by pushing for more sanctions. So one is that. And the other one is to Kelsey. This is all happening in the context of the United States also seeking a deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which would entail, at least that's what the Saudis are requesting, nuclear collaboration. From what is available publicly, it certainly would include enrichment, which means that the United States would abandon the 1-2-3 gold standard that he has had. And most likely, it will not be anywhere near the restrictions imposed by the JCPOA. If that were to happen, given all of the other challenges that the JCPOA or the JCPOA plus whatever variation of it that you think we should be pursuing, how do you see that affecting the likelihood of the Iranians agreeing to what probably would be a stricter deal than the JCPOA, why the United States is granting the Saudis something that goes far less than the JCPOA?
Kelsey, with that question.
Sure. So Saudi Arabia's interest in a nuclear deal with the United States really predates the current discussions about a Saudi-Israeli rapprochement. And what has hampered advancement in these negotiations are the Saudis' demands. Saudi Arabia does not want to agree to more intrusive IAEA monitoring mechanisms. They've refused to ratify what is now really considered the best common practice for safeguards, which is an agreement known as the Additional Protocol. And right now, the only agreement they have in place with the IAEA is outdated, and it's really insufficient for the agency to determine that that Saudi Arabia's nuclear program, you know, remains peaceful and that materials are in peaceful purposes. So there's the monitoring aspect that Saudi Arabia has been, you know, has failed to update. In addition, you know, Saudi Arabia does not want to forgo enrichment and reprocessing. And these are the two methods by which a country can obtain the necessary fissile material for nuclear weapons. And the Trump administration, in my mind, you know, rightly continued to push for a ban on enrichment and reprocessing in its negotiations with Saudi Arabia. And I think this is crucial that the United States, you know, still push for this ban because it's not necessary. I mean, it's not economically viable for Saudi Arabia to have its own uranium enrichment program. And in addition to that, I think it's only going to increase tensions and it's going to raise the risk that other countries in the region are going to want to match Saudi Arabian and Iranian capabilities in enrichment. So I don't think that if, you know, Saudi Arabia starts enriching uranium, we're going to see a proliferation cascade. I don't think we're going to see Saudi Arabia or a lot of other countries dashing to nuclear weapons. But I do think it raises the risk of hedging. It raises the risk of Saudi Arabia, other countries, trying to develop the necessary capabilities to build a nuclear weapon, you know, if the political decision were made to do so. So I think it's really critical that the United States push very hard for a nuclear agreement that bans enrichment and reprocessing, that requires more intrusive monitoring and verification. And, you know, if they can't get a ban, you know, they could look at, say, a 10-year ban on enrichment and reprocessing with an agreement to try to revisit the issue later. And that, again, you know, would create time and space to reexamine the U.S.'s policy writ large towards nuclear capabilities in the Middle East. And maybe part of a negotiation with Iran is a regional component that looks at that question of enrichment and reprocessing, or tries to provide, you know, better alternatives and better guarantees that if countries in the region build nuclear reactors, they'll have assured fuel supplies so they don't have to worry about domestic enrichment. So I think, you know, again, as the U.S. approaches any deal with Saudi Arabia, it has to be sure that it's not making the proliferation risk worse in the Middle East, that it's not driving, you know, future hedging, because that's just going to further destabilize the region, you know, even if, and it's not, in my mind, worth the price of, you know, Israeli-Saudi rapprochement at this time.
Thank you. I'm getting a bunch of questions online about the internal situation in Iran. This is a question from Shariar Afshar. Mahsa Amini's death was an unexpected but pivotal moment that led to the current uprising. What and when will be the next pivotal moments, if any, that may lead to the regime change that the diaspora is expecting? That's kind of the $34,000 question. I don't know. Nader, what do you think could set something off again, especially given the economic situation in the country and how people are struggling?
Well, the obvious choice or the most likely scenario, and this will be a big moment of crisis for the Islamic Republic, will be when the supreme leader passes. It's unclear who's going to replace him. The candidates that have been suggested all suffer from legitimacy issues, not on top of the overall legitimacy crisis that the Islamic Republic faces. So that's going to be a moment of deep uncertainty. And I think it might create spaces and opportunities for the struggle for democracy in Iran to revive itself. Now, we don't know how that's going to play out, but given that the supreme leader is the most powerful person in the Islamic Republic, that he appoints all of the key sort of figureheads that manage the system, his departing from the scene is going to be something to watch for. So obviously, I hope there will be a democratic transition before that happens that will sweep away the supreme leader. But I don't see it happening under the current conditions that we've been talking about, that's really been shaped by this mass, pauperization of the average Iranian citizen because of external sanctions and internal mismanagement. That's going to stay the same. So I don't foresee any sort of major shift or moment until the supreme leader passes away. And perhaps then there might be some opportunities.
Let me ask you this as well, and then I'll get Farnaz and Negar to talk about it. This is from Naveed Aziz. Many believe that the $6 billion that in frozen revenues that are coming from South Korea will empower the Islamic Republic to maintain power over people, and that the funds won't be used for their intended purposes. What are the panelists' reaction to this?
Well, Farnaz had some great reporting on this when the story was broken. If you actually know the details of the negotiations, Iran doesn't have direct access to that money. And all the money goes into Qatar's bank account. They then make purchases for food and medicine based on a request from Iran. So no money goes directly to the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's if you're interested in the details. But if you're interested in sort of the politicized, hysterical sort of commentary that unfortunately shapes the debate on Iran here in this country, then you'll have questions such as the one that was just posed. But the actual facts of the matter suggest things are moving in a very different direction.
And actually, Iran wanted to have direct access to the money. That's one of the reasons this deal was delayed, and they didn't like this arrangement. But nevertheless, this is how it happened. And it's essentially for humanitarian purposes, which is an exemption that has existed in U.S. sanctions laws under Democratic and Republican presidents.
I had a funny experience being on a talk show when these details were coming out from the New York Times, and one of the panelists was a man named Mohammed Marandi, who most of us know is a spokesman for the Iranian government, and he was insisting that no, this money would be going to Iran, it wasn't going to Qatar. And then I saw on social media that a lot of opponents of this agreement were quoting Mohammed Marandi as their trusted source of information. So things get a little scrambled sometimes when you're talking about Iran.
Now we'll trust what Marandi says whenever he makes a statement in this case, but generally he's considered to be a liar, which just highlights the point that I'm trying to make.
Using the Tehran Times as a source of valid information, also very interesting. Farnaz, do you have anything more to say about this question? We know, there is a substantial number of people, particularly in the diaspora, who say you can't have anything to do with this regime. You can't make any concessions to them ever. They will pocket them, and nothing good will come from that. What is the response? I mean, in terms of if you want to deal with the question of Americans held unjustly abroad, or you want to deal with Iran's enrichment program, its centrifuges, and so on. What do you think is the best response to that very, very emotional and valid argument for a lot of people who are just simply fed up with what they see going on in Iran?
I mean, I'd like to point out that this feeling of sort of being betrayed by the international community, or that all these wheeling and dealings that Iran is doing with the U.S. vis-a-vis the detainees and getting access to the $6 billion funds, invitation to BRIC, the Shanghai cooperation, all of these things that the courting of Iran is not very popular even inside Iran, right? It's not just the diaspora that's against these things. It's also the people inside Iran who are really fed up with this regime and kind of feel very alone in their fight for democratic change. They feel that they're the ones that are going out into the streets. Their kids are getting killed. They're getting killed. But but human rights is not really a component of any of these discussions with Iran. And at the very, you know, the we've seen with Syria, with Bashar Assad, we've seen with other examples that countries have interests, right? And the U.S. also puts its own interests before the interests of the Iranian people or of any people. So they don't have enemies, they have interests. This is kind of the saying goes in foreign policy circles. So, yes, the deals are not very popular with the Iranians because they feel like this is just going to give more of a lifeline to their oppressor, to the Islamic Republic. But at the same time, the U.S. wanted to bring the detainees home. And more importantly, they wanted to figure out a way to put to stop Iran from advancing nuclear enrichment. This is presidential election season, and I think the Biden administration didn't want want Iran to suddenly reach 90%. So these diplomatic overtures started as far back as December, as we've reported. So I think this is kind of the situation that Iranians find themselves, that this is a little bit of a, not a little bit, but this is a kind of a big blow to their aspirations for change. And I want to go back to the earlier question of when is the next spark going to come? We don't know. Iran is unpredictable. There's social repression, there's economic hardship, there's all sorts of other things that can ignite another uprising, because the society is very much a powder keg. Because none of these grievances are addressed properly, none of them are resolved, they're only crushed and suppressed. And so that anger, that resentment can erupt again. If something happens, something as increasing, cutting subsidies for energy or increasing gasoline prices or putting, cracking down on hijab, any of these can lead to another protest movement or uprising. We've seen a pattern since 2009 that every time, every couple of years or every year or every wave of protest seems to get more radical, seems to get more angrier, and the demands are sort of evolving from we want reform, we want this presidential candidate, or we want, we're opposing this economic policy, to now we want wholesale change and we want the Islamic Republic gone. So if this pattern continues, then you're going to get each wave of protests building on the previous protest, and the confrontation between the people and the government growing and escalating. And what is it going to take to bring down the Islamic Republic? We've seen that the Islamic Republic is resolved to stay in power, and it is not. And in order to do that, it's willing to open fire and kill even teenagers, as we saw with the horrible, tragic cases of 16-year-old Nikasha Karami and Sarina Ismailzadeh. Both of them were 16-year-old kids who went out to just protest about what they wanted to wear. And the result was that they were beaten to death. So if you're willing to target children, if you're willing to kill teenagers, that means that the people of Iran, as they continue this struggle, are facing a pretty brutal and formidable force. I think that has to also be that realistic of where will this go, has to also be part of any debate, I think, about you know, the uprising in Iran or this desire for democratic change.
If you study revolutions or teach about them, as I do, you know that you need certain ingredients for revolutions to succeed. You need some sort of leadership. We saw in 1978-79, Ayatollah Khomeini from exile sent his cassette tapes through the mosques, through the bazaars in Iran, and he was a rallying point for discontent in Iran. You saw splits in the security forces. Toward the end of the Iranian Revolution, you had 1,000 members of the military defecting every day. You saw widespread strikes. The oil workers, the bazaar, went out on strike. You got a revolution. It took 14 months, but you got a revolution. So, Nader, you're an expert on revolutions. Again, we spoke about the death of the supreme leader, perhaps, but who is the leader of the revolution?
There is no leader, and I think that's in many ways a good thing and a bad thing. It's a bad thing in terms of there's not one popular person that people can rally around. It's a good thing in the sense that there's no one who can then come and assume political power and rally people around his or her political narrative and then, you know, consolidate another authoritarian regime if there's political change. When you were just talking, Barbara, you came pretty close to summarizing a recent political science textbook on the durability of authoritarian regimes by Stephen Levitsky and Lucan Y, where they actually look into this question as to why are some revolutionary regimes in the world more durable than non-revolutionary regimes. And they look at all the major cases, including the one in Iran. Mm-hmm. And they identify three core variables. One, the unity of the ruling elites. During times of crisis, they stick together. The other one is the loyalty of the security forces. Mm-hmm. And the third is the absence of a coherent and legitimate credible opposition. So if you apply all of their factors to the case of Iran and what's been happening in recent years, you see those factors in place. There hasn't been major defections among the ruling elite. There was in 2009 when Rafsanjani basically broke and the reformist leaders were cast aside and they challenged, but the core hardliners stayed together and they continue to stay together with, you know, a little bit of friction here and there. Around the families of the senior hardline leaders, there's been quite a bit of dissent, particularly in the house of Hashemi Rafsanjani, where some of his children are very outspoken and, you know, very adamant in opposing the Islamic Republic. The loyalty of the security forces, as far as we know, there hasn't been any major defections. And I think one of the interesting dynamics about the loyalty of the security forces, not only do you have the Basij militia that has a lot of blood on its hands and the Revolutionary Guard Corps, but there's an added element that I'm very fearful of. If ever push comes to shove in Iran, Iran can rely on the loyalty of these Iranian finance supported Shia militias, the Hashda Shabiya from Iraq, from Syria, who I think have no inhibition coming into Iran and just massacring people during a moment of crisis, saying that we have to support, you know, the Islamic Republic. So that's an added factor. And those of us who desperately want political change in Iran, democratization, we don't want a bloodbath and we don't want to see another Syria. So I think that imposes some moral obligations on our public advocacy in terms of how we want to see this, political change happen, which is why I'm strongly in favor of, you know, nonviolent political resistance and mobilization, which we actually have been seeing in Iran in quite, heroic ways by Iranian women, just defying the regime by not agreeing to wear the hijab. And there's just too many of them for the regime to stop and to reimpose their will. That's, I think, something that needs to be built upon. Of course, it requires sacrifice, and you could be fined, you could go to jail. But I think that type of, I think, strategy is the strategy that we all should be supporting if we're serious about a nonviolent political transition in Iran in the direction of democracy.
We have a question here. 1 second, wait for the microphone.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this fascinating discussion. And I want to go back to the comment that Firnaz made about the medical doctors who are leaving Iran. And the fact is, this is not unique to Iran. I mean, if you look in Egypt, Tunisia, you would see similar figures of brain drain and capital flight all moving towards the Gulf, UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. And those are, like, there is also the push factor and the pull factor where, like, MBS is buying everything from football players to singers to Elon Musk's. And those are not particularly democratic governments and not any better than what we're seeing in Iran. We just saw Saudi Arabia handing the death sentence over a tweet And to what extent we're seeing just like we're kicking the problem down the can towards other countries, then it would be a bigger problem for us, particularly with the rapprochement for the US and Saudi Arabia and the Saudi deal. Thank you.
I don't know who wants to,
I don't know if we're pushing our problem to other countries, but I think you're actually correct in identifying a set of broad regional conditions that apply to Iran and to many other authoritarian regimes in the region. You have these corrupt, unaccountable, despotic, out-of-touch ruling elites who don't really care about their own societies, and they're creating mass poverty and mass pauperization, forcing citizens to flee for a better life. Now, their options that their citizens have are very limited. You know, some of them can go to the Gulf if you have professional training, but to try and get into Europe, to try and get to this country, you might be able to get into Canada because it's a bit more, you know, generous in terms of its immigration policy. But this is a broad regional sort of set of conditions that applies to the region and affects the vast majority of people in the region, and suggests that this region is not headed in the direction that we're hearing from the Biden administration, that there's going to be this Saudi-Israeli normalization deal and we're going to have peace in the Middle East. That's the stuff of fantasy and fiction. The reality for the vast majority of people in the Middle East and North Africa is one of growing misery, suffocating authoritarian regimes. As you mentioned, you tweet something in Saudi Arabia now and you get a death sentence. I mean, and that's not unique to Saudi Arabia. You post something on Twitter or social media in Iran, you'll find yourself in jail. And that's, you know, look what's happening in Jordan. Look what's happening, you know, across the region. So, you know, there is this reality, socioeconomic, political reality across the region that we can see in Iran. Each country has its own different sort of story, but the broad picture and the broad story is exactly the same, which is why I'm deeply skeptical about these narratives we're hearing. If we can only get the Saudi Crown Prince and Netanyahu to sort of come to Washington, D.C. and hug each other, what a wonderful place the Middle East will be. I mean, that's the stuff of fantasy.
The Economist has the new Middle East is
yeah,
their
the new
cover
Middle East,
story.
Exactly.
Well, it's very good for
business.
Business, yeah. Yeah.
But
a
not
lot
for the
people are
of the
making
region.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
Or some people are making a lot of money. Neka, you wanted to add something.
I just wanted to add maybe a more positive note to what was said about the protest. That I think what happened here, yes, the Islamic Republic is dealing with a very serious legitimacy crisis. I don't think they're dealing or not seeing this as an existential crisis imminently bringing the overthrow of the regime. But again, what Fan has explained and how violent and brutal the crackdown has been can essentially is a testament to how serious the legitimacy crisis when you realize that a big portion of the population, the youth, doesn't want the policies or you in general. But what we also saw happen last year, I want to call it a cultural revolution, this feminist uprising. It's been building up on decades, four decades of women slowly and apolitical women, just normal women slowly pushing back on this version of the state's understanding of what the Islamic hijab is, which is even a point of disagreement among Islamic scholars. But the women have slowly pushed it back over the past 40 years, but the past year they made a giant leap, something that would take maybe one or two decades to happen. And I don't think we're going back to last year, to before Mahsa Amini, Jina Amini, September of 2022. The state would like to push them back to where they are, but I think the genie is essentially out of the bottle. And what we're seeing as far as the bravery of women, of young girls saying enough is enough. You can't kill someone for how they're dressed if you don't see it deemed. And I think the way the country also showed up for this young Kurdish girl from a small town, she wasn't a political person. She was an unknown figure who just happened to be at the wrong place, wrong time, and essentially lost her life for the way she was dressed. But I think it was just a beautiful moment to watch. Yes, very violent, very deadly, brutal for those who lost their lives, but also we're not going back to before September of 2022.
I totally agree. And I see someone in the audience who's an authority on this. Did you have a question? Yes.
Thank you. So on the subject of leadership inside Iran and in an effort to hopefully feel somewhat more optimistic about everything, groups of activists, including Mir Hossein Mousavi and former President Mahmoud Khatami, have made calls for a constitutional referendum. And I guess my question is, how viable of a solution do you think that is, given that these groups and these leaders have even cited articles in the Islamic Republic Constitution, which allows for referendums to take place?
I don't know. Farnaz, what do you think? Are the reformists completely extinguished as a political force? We've all seen these calls. I was told there was a two-day meeting on Clubhouse that talked about exactly what this constitutional referendum would be about. But how do you pull it off?
I don't think that's something that we should expect this the current leadership of Iran to even entertain the idea of a referendum, because they know that even though it's allowed within the constitution, it's very possible that the answer to their to whether the people of Iran want their leadership will be a big resounding no. But other than that, I think if we look at how over the past 20 years or so, when the reformist political faction sort of organized and, you know, had the parliament for many years, had the presidency, every turn of reform, serious reform, was blocked by either the supreme leader or by the sort of the clerical committees or hardliner committees that are appointed. And sort of, you know, Iran's government is this system, is this parallel system of elected officials that are supervised by non-elected officials. Sort of this clash has really hindered any sort of reform. I think that if we just look at the last presidential election, where the semblance of an election within the framework of the Islamic Republic became a sham. Right, even people, conservatives, were saying that this is not an election, it's a selection, because they eliminated and disqualified all the candidates that could have possibly rivaled Mr. Raisi. The results were predetermined in that they lined up really unknown candidates, people that didn't really have any popularity, to make sure that Mr. Raisi would get elected. Eliminating all factions, not allowing the Reformist Party to participate. Even hardliners like Ali Larijani were disqualified. And so it was an engineered election process. And we saw, you know, a majority or a big part of the population not vote. I think it was the lowest turnout ever in the past 43 years. So if we look at that, if we look at how tight their the circle is now of power, of how they want to just eliminate any critic, any even from within that system, to have the absolute ideologues and the absolute loyalists in power, that doesn't really leave a lot of room or expectation for something like a referendum.
I have one more nuclear question here, which I want to give to Kelsey before we close. This is from Michelle McKinsky. In view of the next IEA board meeting, i.e. the meeting that's going on now, can we expect some progress in current discussions with Rafael Grossi towards a technical arrangement? As we have seen Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, showing unhappiness with a modus vivendi that was reached in March, McKinsky thinks this reflects huge pressures from the IRGC that are opposed to any relaxation of tensions. Will Khamenei be able to impose a compromise? So explain what this technical arrangement is and how it has been implemented or not implemented, if you would.
So in March, Iran and the IAEA reached an agreement whereby Iran agreed to voluntarily expand some of its nuclear facilities, and it agreed to cooperate with the agency on resolving some issues from its pre-2003 period, when Iran had a nuclear weapons program. Now, unfortunately, we've seen very little progress on actually implementing that agreement. In late April, early May, Iran did reinstall some cameras at one facility that is used to produce centrifuges. But shortly after that, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran was criticized for having cooperated with the International Atomic Energy Agency in a way that some members of Iran's parliament said was contrary to a law that Iran passed in December of 2020, which required a reduction of cooperation, you know, with the IAEA. And so since that late April, early May time, we've seen no real progress on both the enhanced monitoring, but also addressing those issues related to Iran's pre-2003 program. And like I said, both, I think, are deeply problematic. I mean, as I said, the lack of monitoring, you know, puts at risk a future deal, drives speculation about possible covert activities, and failure to address the pre-2003 issues, I think, calls into question Iran's willingness to cooperate with the IAEA. And I think it raises doubts about Iran's intentions. That being said, I do think there is a way to move forward on these issues that would both allow Iran to enhance cooperation, you know, while respecting what was passed in that December 2020 nuclear law. I mean, Iran could agree to allow a certain level of inspections, called technical visits, that are not classified in the JCPOA. So they're not included in the JCPOA, so they're not covered by that December 2020 law. And you know, we have to acknowledge that Iranian leadership has shown a willingness to disregard elements of that law when it's expedient. So I think the Biden administration and the Europeans should also think what they could tangibly put on the table that might entice Iran to be more forthcoming in allowing that monitoring to resume. Because I think Rafael Grossi, you know, very rightly in his comments this morning, you know, talked about the dire situation that the agency is in because of the lack of monitoring and the severe consequences that that really could have in terms of hamstringing the agency's ability to verify future limits. So this has to be a priority. And I think with some creative thinking and some incentives for Iran that provide, you know, some tangible benefits, there is a way forward that could expand that transparency.
You explain what those tangible benefits would be, because here again, we're going to hear you can't give sanctions relief, you're just appeasing them. You're submitting to blackmail. You're submitting to nuclear blackmail. That's what critics will say.
Well, I mean, personally, you know, from my perspective, you know, I think that it is worth providing Iran, you know, with some benefits in order to reduce its nuclear program and reduce the risk of a nuclear armed Iran. Do I like the idea of providing benefits to this Iranian government? No. But, you know, as we talk about, you know, the protesters, as we talk about, you know, supporting a protest movement and, you know, and what the protesters in Iran seek in Iranian governance, I would just say that, you know, regime change is not a viable non-proliferation strategy. I mean, we cannot count on the next government in Iran, you know, deciding that nuclear weapons are not in the country's security benefit. I mean, democracies are interested in nuclear weapons. We're seeing in an intense debate in South Korea right now about whether or not the country should pursue nuclear weapons. So, you know, while I don't like the idea of putting tangible benefits on the table, whether that's, you know, allowing Iran more access to money held abroad, whether that's, you know, allowing, you know, Iran to sell more oil, I think ensuring that both this government and, you know, the next government in Iran is not interested in pursuing nuclear weapons, I think that that is, you know, a worthwhile goal and something that we have to keep in mind, you know, as we, you know, put concessions on the table for Iran in return for nuclear restrictions.
Thank you. We have time for final thoughts from our other speakers. If anybody would like to conclude with how they see the next year shaping up. We have Ibrahim Raisi coming to the United Nations again, which is already causing a great deal of consternation among a lot of people who say that someone with his record, and of course it's not just the crackdown on the Mahsa Amini protests, but his role as a prosecutor in 1988 when 5,000 political prisoners in Iran were summarily killed. A lot of controversy over his appearances in New York. How do you see the next few months going forward? And are there any arguments also that you think might work with this Iranian government, which seems to have doubled down on internal repression and this look east policy when it comes to foreign affairs? So maybe, Farnaz, we'll start with you and then we'll end up here.
I think the next few months are going to be tense months inside Iran between Iranians and the government, because we are approaching a rolling months of anniversary dates. And with each anniversary date of protesters who were killed or executed, there is a renewal of collective trauma and grief and a desire to honor the protesters who were killed in some show of dissent. So how is that going to shape up? We don't know. Are they going to have room to protest or just come out to their rooftops and shout death to the dictator? We don't know how that shape is going to be. But between now and January, which is sort of the, you know, 3-4 months of the uprising last year, I think we're going to have this tension escalate. At the same time, I think we should expect the government to not only double down on the crackdowns, but double down on expanding its diplomacy outside. This is a government that is desperate for to show some sort of achievement, to give some sort of good news, and say that we're able to do something. It has failed to bring about any policy achievements domestically, so it's looking to do that you know, externally. So I think they're probably going to be more engaged with the region, with the West even, certainly expanding relations with China and Russia. I think that alliance is only going to keep getting strengthened, especially if in the absence of a nuclear deal. And I think that the we didn't really get to discuss the shadow war with Israel, but that's also a big part of Iran's sort of you know, resources and energy and concern is you know, Israel's intelligence infiltration inside Iran and this shadow war that they're engaged with at land, sea, cyber, and everywhere. So I think we gotta watch out for how that's going to evolve as well. So I think the next couple of months, tensions and difficulties at home, and an attempt to strengthen ties abroad.
Last thoughts?
Yeah, I don't expect any sort of major, you know, game-changing event that will put us somewhere different with respect to Iran. I think Farnaz is absolutely right. We can see layer upon layer of protest. The discontent is there. It's very deep. It's going to get worse. But I think this is a regime that, from its perspective, is feeling a bit confident right now that we repressed this wave of protest. You know, we've weathered the sanctions, we're joining BRICS, there seems to be, but like all authoritarian regimes, not just in Iran, but across the region and around the world, you know, they're living on borrowed time because they suffer from a crisis of legitimacy. They, you know, they're just trying to, you know, plan for the next, you know, short term to crush dissent, to figure out where there's no time. I mean, the good news of this story is that time, I think, fundamentally, is on the side of the opposition to this regime. Time is not on the side of the regime itself. There's no way it can shift course. There's no sort of plan that I see that's going to sort of quelch this deep desire for political change in Iran. That's going to stay there and it's going to get worse. I think the real challenge for us, at least those of us living outside of Iran, is how can we best shape the policies of our own governments to create better internal conditions for the struggle for democracy in Iran right now. The sad story is that U.S. foreign policy, I would say, right since 1979, moving forward, has not been on the side for the struggle for democracy. And it's actually inadvertently strengthened the regime, not the the desire for political change. And I think that's where we should be focusing our attention.
Nagar, Biden has just been in Vietnam, and we're seeing this relationship between a country that we pummeled with bombs and bullets. At the same time, that's an extremely authoritarian regime as well. I don't know, is that the future of us with Iran, a relationship with another authoritarian regime?
I don't don't know how much of a relationship we're looking at. You remember after the JCPOA in the second Obama term, when the Cuban embassy opened, there was expectation that maybe the former Iranian embassy is going to be next, and they were go on a roll sort of, and that was stopped with the change of presidency. I think it also, that relationship depends on what happens here. Is there going to be a second Biden term, another Democrat? Is there going to be a return of past Republican president or any other Republicans? That really will be determining the relations. As far as internally, I think what we're seeing, and I agree with Fanaz on that, what we're seeing is a shorter interval between protests. Again, the grievances are there. They're not being addressed. They're just piling up. It's a young society, majority 70% under the age of 40, highly educated female population, modern, tech savvy. And you know, they want a better future. They want change. They want political change. They want economic prospects, social, cultural. In every way, they feel repressed and not the government not meeting their needs. So I think we're going to see more. And also, we don't know what the sparks are. Usually the Islamic Republic provides the spark, like killing a young girl for how she was dressed, or suddenly raising the price of gasoline, or other sparks that they themselves didn't even foresee as being something that would start another mass movement. But we might see even more of that, and I think in shorter intervals.
Thank you very much to all my panelists. You have exceeded my expectations for a really serious and thoughtful discussion on Iran. So thank you to everyone who has tuned in online and here at Stimson. And check out Middle East Voices. We have several pieces about what Iranians are going through, including a very interesting piece about how women are using the internet and social connections to try to build their own small businesses, and how their increasing economic role in the family is changing the way they are regarded even in traditional families, which is another part of this cultural revolution that Negar was talking about. So hope to see you again soon, and thank you very much again.
That was a panel conversation held on September 11th at the Stimson Center here in Washington, D.C. Thank you for tuning into the Iran podcast. We are available on all major podcast applications, so don't forget to subscribe to us. And if you can, please leave a review and a comment. You can also support our work by going to Spotify, and you can follow us on Twitter or X. Our handle is @IranPodcast. I'm your host, Negar Murtazavi, and until next time, goodbye.